Welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. Our 30-minute program is designed for English learners. Today, we listen to another segment of What It Takes, a podcast from the American Academy of Achievement. The subject is one of America's greatest chefs, Thomas Keller. Also later, I'll tell you about a Syrian exile who creates artwork to help keep the memory of his homeland alive. But first, we have this report from Susan Shand and Dorothy Gundy.
Vitaly Bespalov had no idea what to expect when he arrived at a business center in St. Petersburg, Russia, to ask for a job. Everything about the building seemed unusual to the 23-year-old reporter. There was a lot of security. The windows were darkened. Guards dressed like soldiers asked him where he lived. They examined his passport. As he was talking with them, a woman entered the building. She appeared to be extremely angry. Bespalov said she was yelling something about how she refused to be a part of this. He added, "Everything about the place was strange." The year was 2014. The place was the Internet Research Agency, a company which would hire Bespalov. The Internet Research Agency now faces criminal charges in the United States. The Justice Department has accused it of illegal interference in the 2016 U.S. presidential election. Bespalov recently described his experiences working at the Internet Research Agency to VOA.
Bespalov had moved from his home in Siberia to St. Petersburg to work at a local news website, but he did not get the job. So he began to search for writing or reporting positions. One day, he received a promising call. There was an opening for a writing job that paid double the usual amount. "I had no idea who it was," Bespalov said. "They just called and told me to show up tomorrow at this address, Savushkina 55. And I didn't understand what the job was or what the company was. But I said, sure, why not?" Bespalov met there with a woman named Anna. He took a writing test and provided examples of his reporting. He described them as sympathetic pieces on Russia's opposition movement. "I still don't understand why they took me," he says, adding that his politics were clearly anti-government. But Anna came back with a smile and said, "Well, we don't cover the kind of stories you do, but you know how to write."
On his first day, Bespalov was asked to cover the war in Ukraine. He was told to rewrite reports from other websites for a few fake Ukrainian news sites. The goal was to make the reports seem fresh and pro-Russian government. Bespalov said he quickly understood he was working at the center of a propaganda machine. He said he was faced with only two possibilities. He could leave the so-called troll factory immediately to protect his professional image, or he could stay to learn more about the place and write a big story about it. Bespalov went with a second choice. He became a mole among trolls. He says the job demanded a lot. Teams worked 8 to 12 hours around the clock, 7 days a week. Supervisors watched their work. Cameras were deployed all over the building. The company discouraged employees from talking to each other.
But Bezpalov did have short discussions with other workers during breaks. He said most seemed not to care or think about what they were doing. I know people who've been there for 3 years and never thought once what it was all about. They were there for the money, he says. Bezpalov said it was a highly structured operation, with a newsroom on one floor and bloggers and social media workers on another. There was also an images department. Bezpalov said the goal of all this was to complete what he called a circle of lies. The bloggers and social media operation supported state media news to push one central idea. Bezpalov called that idea Make Russia Great Again.
Bezpalov worked at the agency for 3.5 months to learn as much about the organization as he could. Then he quit. He published a report on his investigation in 2015. He said he did not use his own name as the writer because he was worried for his safety. Later, he was threatened, he says, after others at the IRA began to suspect that the report was his work. Other reports came out, and the threats stopped. Everybody knew about it, he says. Bezpalov says he has very little additional information about the Internet Research Agency. But, he said, it had started looking for English speakers around the time he quit. Bezpalov said his actions have been misrepresented in Russia and the United States. He said people in the U.S. do not call him a reporter, but a former troll. And in Russia, he is considered a treasonous liar. He said his friends want him to stop talking because they fear he will be killed. Now it appears the IRA worked to influence Russia's 2018 presidential campaign. An internet user named Kremlobot, claiming to work for IRA's Russian language group, posted that employees worked to raise voter numbers. Facebook and Reddit social media sites have removed accounts each company identified as connected to the IRA. The Russian government has denied any connection to or direct knowledge of the company. I'm Susan Shand.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.
Syrian-born artist Mohammed Hafez saves memories of his home country through dioramas. His models show life in Syria, both before and during the current conflict. Hafez uses little pieces of metal, wood, and stone to represent people and their communities. He also uses recorded voices and images of everyday life in Syria. He captured them with his camera before the fighting started in 2011. Hafez told VOA, "I recorded everything I could get my hands on. People's conversations in cafes, the calling for prayers in mosques, the bells of churches, the conversation of a taxi driver, and voices of children playing in the courtyard of Umayyad Mosque." Mohammed Hafez said the recordings provide examples of everyday life And Hafez said he believes art helps rebuild the spirit of Syria's past and present and protect the beauty of his culture. 1 year after the war began, he found the recordings and images he had made. The artist said that he felt, after their discovery, he had found a new purpose in life. He was meant to tell the story of his country and keep memories of it for the next generation of Syrians. Hafez said that, as an artist, he is supposed to bring hope to his people, to rebuild their homeland and live in peace. On this earth, there is something worth living for, he added. Hafez now lives in exile in the American state of Connecticut. Since 2009, he has worked as an architect in the city of New Haven. Recently, he received special recognition from Yale University. He was named a 2018 Yale University Silliman College Fellow. Hafez came to the United States on a student visa in 2003 and studied at Iowa State University. Once in the U.S., it took him several years to go back to his home in Syria. The war in Syria has caused millions of Syrians to flee their homes and seek safety within or outside the country. Mohammed Hafez is an activist for refugees and their rights. You do not need to be a refugee to understand the memories and the feelings of them. We should understand that circumstances forced these people to leave their homes, he said. We should treat them as real humans who share the same feelings as we do, he added. Hafez said he wants to represent the common quality that connects Syrian refugees with the rest of the world. I am trying to tell the stories of the refugees from all religions and backgrounds, Hafez said. The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees estimates there are more than 6 million Syrian refugees living in neighboring countries. More than half of them are reported to be in Turkey. Next up, what it takes. Today, host Alice Winkler features Thomas Keller, the American chef.
I began my career at 15 in front of a Hobart dishwasher. My mother ran restaurants when I was a child. I was the youngest of five boys. My father was also in the military, so we traveled around a lot. She kept an eye on my older brother, Joseph, and I. We were the two youngest. He got to peel vegetables and work with the cooks, and I got to be in front of the dishwasher. But it's amazing what you learn at those least expected times.
That is Thomas Keller. Yes, chef. He makes some of the best food in America.
I learned six disciplines standing in front of that dishwasher that became the cornerstone of my success. I learned about organization, how important organization was. The waiters come in with their dirty dishes and their dirty glasses and their dirty silverware, and they don't know where to put it. They would just throw it anywhere. So you have to set an example for them. This size plate goes here, this size plate goes there, the silverware goes here, the glasses go there. Organization was key. And as a young person, I became organized. Efficiency. Efficiency was key as well. I needed to understand the dynamics and the timing of being able to wash all these different dishes, all these different pieces of serviceware, how to get ready to wash which ones at what point, to have it ready to go where they needed to go throughout the restaurant. Efficiency was critical. The need for critical feedback, became apparent to me. If I didn't scrape the dishes correctly or rinse them off correctly, put them in the dish machine, 90 seconds later the door would open and they would still be dirty. I knew I didn't do a good job immediately. Right away, I had to start all over again. Repetition. Repetition was key. Learning to enjoy the same thing over and 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 over again. I realized I really liked repetition. It gave me a great sense of comfort. It was actually liberating after a while because the more you do something, the more you used to get to doing it, the more time you have to think about what you're going to do after that. What is your next goal? Repetition was key for me. Rituals. The idea of rituals. Every day doing the same thing at the same time. You had to empty the water out of the dish machine at specific times. You had to empty the garbage at specific times. You had to sweep the floor at specific times. You had to take out the garbage at specific times. You do these things, and they became ritualistic for you. I like that. I like that kind of order in my life. And then lastly was teamwork. Understanding that no matter what position you held in that kitchen, you were as important as everybody else. Everybody relied on me. The cooks needed me desperately. They needed their plates, or else they couldn't plate the food. The bartenders needed their glasses. The waiters and waitresses needed their knives and forks. They needed their silverware. And they all relied on me, creating great teamwork. I love that.
You can find the whole podcast on our website, learningenglish.voanews.com. Now it's time for an American story. Here is the second and final part of Paul's Case by Willa Cather.
Paul was a student with a lot of problems. He hated school. He didn't like living with his family on Cordelia Street in the industrial city of Pittsburgh. Paul wanted to be surrounded by beautiful things. He loved his part-time job as an usher at the concert hall. He helped people find their seats before the concert. Then he could listen to the music and dream of exciting places. Paul also spent a lot of time at the local theater. He knew many of the actors who worked there. He used to do little jobs for them, and they would let him see plays for free. Paul had little time left for his studies, so he was always in trouble with his teachers. Finally, Paul's teachers complained again to his father. His father took him out of school and made him take a job in a large company. He would not let Paul go near the concert hall or the theater. Paul did not like his job as a messenger boy. He began to plan his escape. A few weeks later, Paul's boss, Mr. Denny, gave Paul a large amount of money to take to the bank. He told Paul to hurry because it was Friday afternoon. He said the bank would close soon and would not open again until Monday. At the bank, Paul took the money out of his pocket. It was $5,000. Paul put the money back in his coat pocket, and he walked out of the bank. He went to the train station and bought a one-way ticket for New York City. That afternoon, Paul left Pittsburgh forever. The train traveled slowly through a January snowstorm. The slow movement made Paul fall asleep. The train whistle blew just as the sun was coming up. Paul awoke, feeling dirty and uncomfortable. He quickly touched his coat pocket. The money was still there. It was not a dream. He really was on his way to New York City with $5,000 in his pocket. Finally, the train pulled into Central Station. Paul walked quickly out of the station and went immediately to an expensive clothing store for men. The salesman was very polite when he saw Paul's money. Paul bought two suits, several white silk shirts, some silk ties of different colors. Then he bought a black tuxedo suit for the theater, a warm winter coat, a red bathrobe, and the finest silk underclothes. He told the salesman he wanted to wear one of the new suits and the coat immediately. The salesman bowed and smiled. Paul then took a taxi to another shop where he bought several pairs of leather shoes and boots. Next, he went to the famous jewelry store, Tiffany's, and bought a tie pin and some brushes with silver handles. His last stop was a luggage store where he had all his new clothes put into several expensive suitcases. It was a little before 1 o'clock in the afternoon when Paul arrived at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel. The doorman opened the hotel's glass doors for Paul, and the boy entered. The thick carpet under his feet had the colors of 1,000 jewels. The lights sparkled from crystal chandeliers. Paul told the hotel clerk he was from Washington, D.C. He said his mother and father were arriving in a few days from Europe. He explained he was going to wait for them at the hotel. In his dreams, Paul had planned this trip to New York 100 times. He knew all about the Waldorf Astoria, one of New York's most expensive hotels. As soon as he entered his rooms, he saw that everything was perfect, except for one thing. He rang the bell and asked for fresh flowers to be sent quickly to his rooms. When the flowers came, Paul put them in water, and then he took a long, hot bath. He came out of the bathroom wearing the red silk bathrobe. Outside his windows, the snow was falling so fast that he could not see across the street. But inside, the air was warm and sweet. He lay down on the sofa in his sitting room. It had all been so very simple, he thought. When they had shut him out of the theater and the concert hall, Paul knew he had to leave. But he was surprised that he had not been afraid to go. He could not remember a time when he had not been afraid of something, even when he was a little boy. But now he felt free. He wasn't afraid anymore. He watched the snow until he fell asleep. It was 4 o'clock in the afternoon when Paul woke up. He spent nearly an hour getting dressed. He looked at himself often in the mirror. His dark blue suit fit him so well that he did not seem too thin. The white silk shirt and the blue and lilac tie felt cool and smooth under his fingers. He was exactly the kind of boy he had always wanted to be. Paul put on his new winter coat and went downstairs. He got into a taxi and told the driver to take him for a ride along Fifth Avenue. Paul stared at the expensive stores. As the taxi stopped for a red light, Paul noticed a flower shop. Through the window, he could see all kinds of flowers. Paul thought the violets, roses, and lilies of the valley looked even more lovely because they were blooming in the middle of winter. Paul began to feel hungry, so he asked the taxi driver to take him back to the hotel. As he entered the dining room, the music of the hotel orchestra floated up to greet him. He sat at a table near a window. The fresh flowers, the white tablecloth, and the colored wine glasses pleased Paul's eyes. The soft music, the low voices of the people around him, and the soft popping of champagne corks whispered into Paul's ears. "This is what everyone wants," he thought. He could not believe he had ever lived in Pittsburgh on Cordelia Street. That belonged to another time and place. Paul lifted the crystal glass of champagne and drank the cold, precious, bubbling wine. He belonged here. Later that evening, Paul put on his black tuxedo and went to the opera. He felt perfectly at ease. He had only to look at his tuxedo to know he belonged with all the other beautiful people in the opera house. He didn't talk to anyone, but his eyes recorded everything. Paul's golden days went by without a shadow. He made each one as perfect as he could. On the eighth day after his arrival in New York, he found a report in the newspaper about his crime. It said that his father had paid the company the $5,000 that Paul had stolen. It said Paul had been seen in a New York hotel. And it said Paul's father was in New York. He was looking for Paul to bring him back to Pittsburgh. Paul's knees became weak. He sat down in a chair and put his head in his hands. The dream was ended. He had to go back to Cordelia Street, back to the yellow-papered bedroom, the smell of cooked cabbage, the daily ride to work on the crowded streetcars. Paul poured himself a glass of champagne and drank it quickly. He poured another glass and drank that one too. Paul had a taxi take him out of the city and into the country. The taxi left him near some railroad tracks. Paul suddenly remembered all the flowers he had seen in a shop window his first night in New York. He realized that by now, every one of those flowers was dead. They had had only one splendid moment to challenge winter. A train whistle broke into Paul's thoughts. He watched as the train grew bigger and bigger. As it came closer, Paul's body shook. His lips wore a frightened smile. Paul looked nervously around as if someone might be watching him. When the right moment came, Paul jumped. And as he jumped, he realized his great mistake. The blue of the ocean and the yellow of the desert flashed through his brain. He had not seen them yet. There was so much he had not seen. Paul felt something hit his chest. He felt his body fly through the air far and fast. Then everything turned black, and Paul dropped back into the great design of things.
That is all the time we have for today. For VOA Learning English, I'm Katie Weaver. Thanks for listening.